WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema is wrapping up this weekend. Tomorrow night, the festival honors cinematographer Ed Lockman for his passion for pushing the limits of the art form in both high-profile Hollywood features and low-budget documentaries. Lockman has worked with some of the most original film directors of our time, including Jean-Luc Godard, Bernardo Bertolucci, Werner Herzog, and Paul Schrader. He also shot the documentaries Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, Say Amen, Somebody, and The World of Mother Teresa. And he's made music videos for John Cale and Lou Reed, Elvis Costello, and Annie Lennox. He shot two films which will be released this summer, London Kills Me, written and directed by Hanif Qureshi, and Light Sleeper, directed by Paul Schrader. I asked Lockman first about collaborating with the brilliant and eccentric Godard on the 1982 film Passion.
The first time I met him, he said to me, you know, I don't understand why a cameraman gets so much money. He said, Kodak does 75% of the work, and the camera does another 5%, and that maybe leaves the director another 10% of the work, and that only leaves 10% for the cameraman. So I didn't know what to say, you know.
Was it funny when he said to you that he thinks cinematographers are overpaid because they only do 10% of the work? I mean,
yeah,
I'm not sure. Did he mean that to be funny?
Yeah, he meant that to be funny in a way. And
I'm glad you're confident of it.
Yeah.
It would be a miserable way to open a conversation with you, wouldn't it?
Well, he wanted to negotiate my salary with me, I guess.
Americans are always reasonably baffled at the French obsession with Jerry Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you went to see a Jerry Lewis film with Jean-Luc Godard. Was this your idea?
Well,
to a Jerry Lewis film?
Yeah, I was in his office one day, and he told me he was going to a Jerry Lewis film, so I said to him, I found that amusing, and I thought he was doing kind of an injustice to our cinema by, you know, what was his obsession about Jerry Lewis? So he said, have you ever seen a Jerry Lewis film? So I said, well, maybe on television, but I don't think really in a cinema. So he said, why don't you come with me? So I went with him, and he was in tears, you know, and I was in tears watching him. And again, you see, I think what happens culturally, and this even happens to foreign films here, I believe, that another culture sees in a film the representation of that culture. In other words, he represents something, again, in a heightened reality, in some level of, maybe you could even say in a Brechtian sense, what we are as a people culturally. And even though Jerry Lewis is bigger than life, Europeans see us bigger than life.
So Godard thought that...
He sees him somehow as some metaphor for a certain psyche or consciousness about America, and that's what he finds about Jerry Lewis. It's so funny, you know.
I feel compelled to say here the French have never seen The Telephones, probably, but so Godard really loved the movie. The movie was Hardly Working.
Yeah.
Did you like the movie?
Not especially, but I enjoyed watching him. You know, enjoy it. And actually, that's another story. I was 35, and I told him it was my birthday that day, and he said, well, I didn't get to take you out on your birthday when you were 16, and so I can take you out on your birthday when you're 35 and maybe when you're 70. So, and which are the gauges of the film, 16 millimeter, 35, 70. Again, that was a way of him being
right, completely
funny.
Filmic mind.
Yeah,
now, you worked with Werner Herzog, and you shot Strosek.
Yeah,
for him, and a film called La Soufrière, which is a really odd film. And this is a documentary about a volcano that was erupting on the island of Guadeloupe,
mm-hmm.
and everybody had evacuated except for one person, and he wanted to find that one person who hadn't mm-hmm. evacuated.
Well, I got a call from him early one morning, and he was in the editing room, and he said to me, I read about this volcano that's going to have an atomic blast worth so many megatons, and I want to go there and make this film. I hear there's a group of people or this lone individual that has risked God and country and is won't be evacuated. I want to go find them. And it was early, and my response was, what film stock are we shooting? And where is Guadalupe? And then when I was on the plane, I realized this is insanity, but, you know, the idea of making the film took over any other presence. You always feel like you're omnipresent making a film anyway, in a way. And I arrived to Punta Pitra, the capital, and everyone was being evacuated, and there was no Werner Herzog. And I thought this was real insanity, and this was, you know, kind of a suicide mission. And lo and behold, he arrived a day later, and myself and Werner, and there was one other cameraman, and we made this film. And the island shaped like a butterfly, and we made the film on the other part. That was the part where the volcano La Soufriere was, and kind of our search was to find this group of people or this individual, and they weren't going to let anybody in that part of the island, but I guess they thought he was some German romantic, and it was kind of insanity and suicidal, and they let us in. And
well, why did you decide to stay, knowing that the situation was dangerous enough that everybody else was evacuating just as you were moving in?
Yeah, I think it was just kind of, we were caught up in the idea that this was our mission, and it was kind of maybe some foolhardy romantic idea, you know. And then I believed in Werner, you know. I mean, there's a certain strength, and his films are always about kind of man pitted against natural elements, you know, and that's kind of the world that you enter with him. Even though he's really, on a one-to-one level, one of the most sane people you know, because he's very honest and straightforward, you know, and he would never put himself in risk that he wouldn't put someone, I mean, he would always put himself in risk be above someone else first. I mean, and actually, it didn't really dawn on me until I was in Basse Terre, and it was like a strange science fiction film, because we would enter people's houses and there would still be food on the table. We entered a hospital, there was babies' clothes in the waiting room. It was like a strange science fiction film. Actually, it was very peaceful. It was very calming. But you could see the volcano kind of smoking. And also, I think process of filmmaking, you feel like you're invincible in a way. And I was much younger. But at this time, it dawned on me, because he went off and I was left alone to do a series of shots of things I found. There were a pack of dogs running around. And I said to Werner at that time, that's when it dawned on me that I was in imminent danger. And I said to Werner, what will happen if the volcano erupts? And he said, just go to the water, because there was a port there, and there'll be a boat there to pick you up. And then he went off. And I go, wait a minute. Who's going to know I'm here? What boat's going to come to pick me up? And at that point, I realized that I had entered some insane, you know, expedition, but it didn't really matter at that point. The film kind of was more important. And
Were the gases from the smoking volcano affecting the shots that you were getting? Were they
actually
affecting the light?
It was very ethereal there because of the it was fog in that area and whatever. But actually, that's what people don't know, that actually the poisonous gas is what kills you before
hot
lava.
Good news. When did you find this out?
Well, it was there. There were some volcanologists there. But that was an interesting sideline, too, because all these different volcanologists came to try to figure out what they would do to stop the volcano. The French wanted to put a cork in it. The Americans wanted to blow it up. They thought that would be a way to eradicate the problem, an American solution. Just bomb it. The Italians wanted to put it out with water. You know, everyone had their own idea.
Did you get that on film?
Oh, sure. Sure, that's not in the film, but there was this news conference that we filmed, and everyone came up with their theory about what they could do to eradicate a volcano.
So you were inhaling these poisonous gases?
Well, they actually weren't poisonous. We were actually, as Werner says in the film, it was about an inevitable catastrophe that never happened. And
so what's your favorite shot of everything you got from this life-threatening experience?
I think maybe some of the helicopter shots, because there was no real helicopter mount. I was just hand-hold sitting in the door. It was a military helicopter that at the last minute they gave permission for us to go up, and they were so ethereal and beautiful. I think those were the things. And also it was the first time I really got to see where we were, what we were surrounded by, I guess.
My guest is cinematographer and director Ed Lachman. He's collaborated with Jean-Luc Godard, Bernardo Bertolucci, Werner Herzog, Paul Schrader, and David Byrne, to name a few. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Cinematographer and director Ed Lachman is my guest. Another director you've worked with is Bernardo Bertolucci, whose movies include Last Tango in Paris, The Conformist, The Last Emperor, and you shot Luna.
Well, I only shot the New York scenes of La Luna.
Okay. Now, his work is, I think of his work as being very, very composed, especially something like The Last Emperor and The Conformist. Did you find that working with him was a different kind of experience, and that you had to be less improvisatory, more kind of careful, pre-planned than you have with many other directors?
Well, there are certain directors that you enter their own visual world.
Yeah.
Let's say Wim Wenders I've worked with, and Werner Herzog, and Bernardo Bertolucci, and Paul Schrader. I was very familiar, and actually I did my thesis on an early film of Bernardo's before the revolution, and that's how I met Bernardo. And he's really a great cameraman in himself. I mean, he's created his own visual language to express his ideas. So he actually gets on the camera and operates the shot until it's in his mind's eye, and then he gives over the camera to the operator. And then the director of photography in his situation, even Victoria Storaro, does the lighting. And he might have some ideas, but he really leaves that up to the cameraman. So I'd really have to say Bernardo is his own cameraman.
You are, I understand, pretty selective about the films that you do. And among the films that you've turned down include Twins, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film, and Ghostbusters 2. Now, listening to you talk, I mean, you sound really like you have a very intellectual approach to making movies. Why they would have wanted someone who thinks like you do to make these kind of big pop, box office smashes, or potential smashes, is kind of beyond me. You seem like you'd be the wrong choice.
Well, I don't want to say, everything in Hollywood is, to be pejorative or to say everything in Hollywood is, negative. I don't mean that. It was just I read the script, and generally I'm drawn either to the director or to the material in itself, And I guess in those two situations, the material, maybe I made a mistake, but the material didn't appeal to me. I didn't feel that visually I would contribute something different that somebody else couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And I guess I based it on the directors, that I wasn't that drawn to their work, so I just didn't pursue it. And why would they be drawn to me? So much happens in that world that if you work on a successful film, being an actor, director, cameraman, you're a success.
Right.
If you work on and I guess Desperately Seeking Susan was a success and kind of a real sleeper in Hollywood's eyes, where Susan Sidelman came from, where this material came from. Then I was the new quotient, the new kid on the block, so everybody wants what's ever new, it was probably by chance as anything else why they showed any interest.
I want to talk a little bit about your background, because there's movies in your personal history. Your father ran a movie house, a movie theater?
Yeah, actually, my father's from Pennsylvania. He's from Chester, was from Chester. And he went to the University of Penn, and my mother went to Drexel University, and they met in Philadelphia. So that's, I guess, my background to Philadelphia. But her father owned vaudeville. So he actually had was in liquor. He was a Hungarian immigrant, and when the Prohibition came in, he bought vaudeville theaters. And when vaudeville went out, they became movie houses. And when my mother and father met, I guess that's how he got involved in. He ran one of the movie theaters in New Jersey, and then he owned one of the movie theaters himself. And then he imported Arc Carbons. They're the light projected on the screen. Now they're used. And he was also the first to bring in xenon bulbs. That's what's replaced Arc Carbons. So I was always around the cinema, you know, but I never took it very seriously. And only when I was in art school did I start to get appreciate or see the possibilities of what image making was in cinema.
Did you ever sit in the projectionist booth at the theater?
I was putting the popcorn in the bags, and I think I liked musicals when I was younger because I'd sing to the screen and, you know, thought it was my father's theater. I could do anything, but I don't know. I thought it was just kind of entertainment. I never took it very seriously. Yeah.
So the turning point was going to art school?
Yeah, I think at art school.
Because you were studying painting?
Yeah, I was studying the visual arts, and I went to Harvard for a while and then Columbia, and I always took kind of film courses. The only real film school I went to was at Ohio University, and that was just kind of, again, carved out of the art school there, and we had a camera and a processor because of the football team, and we went off and made films.
So when you started to take movies seriously, did you go through a period of thinking that the only serious films were serious art films from Europe?
Well, I didn't even know about those. I guess in college, one of the first films I saw that I got interested in imagery was Umberto D, an Italian filmmaker, De Sica's film, because it's so strongly, it was a neorealistic film, and it was so strongly based on the imagery. And I guess that's why I went to Europe then. I went to art school in Europe and France, and that's where I met a lot of these young directors, you know, in Germany, because Germany was at that time in the 60s trying to reunite itself culturally with the rest of the world, and they were funding money to this scene that was happening in Munich and in Berlin. And that's where I met Werner Herzog, and through Werner I met Wim, and then I met Fassbinder, and later I met Schlondorf, and I just happened to work with all those people.
Having gotten your start in European films, but also having made a lot of films in America, do you think that there are still any stylistic differences between American and European films?
No, I think the American independent scene, more and more, it's becoming one cinema. You know, it's just, the difference is that there's a personal vision, you know, that there's an individual vision towards the filmmaking, rather than, you know, the bigger the production, you know, the more coverage, in a way, you know. I mean, it's not to say that. I think Europe has a longer tradition in imagery, and they trust images to tell their stories. Where we're more based, kind of, in words, and a lot of our filmmakers and writers come out of television, you know, and maybe also in the producing end. Maybe that's the big difference. That there's a distinction made in Europe between, let's say, that a film can be made purely for artistic reasons, and films can be made for commercial reasons. Though everybody wants them both to be commercially viable, here, you know, one doesn't make a film unless they feel that there's some commercial success for the film. So purely, let's say, artistic ventures are much more difficult to finance.
Very few people who go to the movies pay any attention to who the cinematographer is. Do you wish that things were different and that more people knew the work of the cinematographers, just as more people now seem to know who the directors are?
No, I think it's all one, you know, I think of myself as a craftsman, you know, and probably we have more recognition now than ever, you know. But no, I think the work in itself is most important. That the photography shouldn't stand out outside of what the work is in itself, you know. So you know, I think this all came about because of auteurism and the idea. But, you know, it's this collective process that makes the film.
Has the technology changed so much since you started that your technique or what you can do is really different?
Well, you know, they made faster and faster film stocks. It means the film can respond to light at much lower levels. They've made lenses that are faster and faster, meaning that they... So I think what's happened, and they made cameras smaller and smaller. So what's happened is it allows us to, like, be in and around things that are happening around us. I mean, I think, like, video is important because, again, you know, it's become more of a democratic process. Anybody can make a film, you know, and create change. And the Rodney King episode, you know, that's, and I think that's important that, you know, that it can be a tool not of just of the rich or the elite, that it can be a tool for anyone to express, you know, their innermost ideas and beliefs.
Since your grandfather and your father ran movie theaters, do you despair now when you go to the movies at the, you know, all the multiplexes? Some of them are really nice and new, but some of them have gotten incredibly small and really run down.
The size of the theater, I just care about the projection, you know, that the demise of, especially in New York City, how poor the projection facilities are. And the answer usually is when I go up to the booth that, well, no one else has complained, you know.
You go up to the booth?
All the time. You know, if they miss focus or, sure.
Do you identify yourself? Hi, Ed Lachman, cinematographer here,
and you're
out of focus.
I usually say I know the cinematographer, and I know that's not what they would, you know, appreciate.
One last question for you. Has anybody ever told you look like the young Woody Allen?
Yeah, but then I met Woody Allen. I didn't get the resemblance, but yeah, people have told me that.
Oh, really? How'd you meet him?
I actually shot an end sequence to Alice that wasn't used.
Oh.
That he wanted a kind of someone that could deal with documentary and narrative. It was, you know, when she finds herself and that she's going to go work for Mother Teresa, he wanted sequences of homeless in New York, and he wanted footage shot in New York of the homeless. And I went out with Pam Yates and did footage in New York of that.
Ed Lachman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the award from the festival.
Thank you.
Ed Lachman will be honored tomorrow night at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.